Chapter 45. Lethal Lawyers. It's an amusing paradox that many of the qualities required by a good lawyer are those that are required by a good criminal. Enterprise, coolness, and the courage to take risks. All three are demonstrated in the famous Earl Rogers story of the gun trick. Earl Rogers was one of America's greatest and possibly most cunning criminal lawyers. He was a vain man, a bad loser, and a heavy drinker, but he also had the quality of a real-life Perry Mason. It was on a hot August day around the turn of the century that three men sat around a table in a gambling joint in Catalina Island, California, playing poker. One of them was a professional gambler named Yeager, also known as the Louisville Sport. The other two were business partners, Al Boyd and Harry Johnson. They proposed to buy a cigar store together, mostly with Boyd's capital, but the way this game was going, they'd soon have no capital left. Johnson wanted to cut their losses and to quit. Boyd, a compulsive gambler, wanted to continue playing, convinced that he could win back everything he'd lost. But the point eventually came where he had nothing left but his gold watch. Suddenly, there was the sound of two shots. Yeager's hat jumped off his head and rolled across the room, and the Louisville Sport slumped across the table. An ace that he had just dealt off the bottom of the pack lay in front of him, stained with the blood that ran from the hole in his forehead. Harry Johnson rushed to the door, holding a gun. "He shot him! My God, he shot him!" he cried, handing the bartender the gun, which was still smoking. Sitting at the table, his partner looked drunk and bewildered. Later, Al Boyd appeared in court, charged with the murder of the Louisville Sport. The chief witness against him was his partner, Harry Johnson. Johnson was young and blonde, and he looked honest and reliable. The jury liked him. But Earl Rogers was convinced that Harry Johnson had shot the gambler. Questioned by his lawyer, McComas, Johnson told the story of the gambling session. Al Boyd had lost everything but his watch. He begged the gambler to advance him $100 on the watch so that he could continue gambling. Yeager said the watch wasn't worth two bits and laughed at him. In a rage, Boyd pulled his gun and shot Yeager. Then he threw the gun down, Johnson picked it up and ran to the door. Under further examination, Johnson admitted that he had had an arrangement with the Louisville Sport. He would get a percentage of his friend's losses as a payment for steering him into the game. This admission worried Earl Rogers. If it was true, it meant that Johnson had no conceivable motive for shooting the gambler. He was going to get his cut anyway. Rogers grilled Johnson as to why he hadn't told about this arrangement at the preliminary hearing. Johnson flushed and said that he was ashamed of what people might think. Rogers pointed out to the jury that this open-faced young man had been double-crossing his closest friend, but he could tell that they weren't too indignant about this. California was a rough place and business was business. It was clear that Johnson was unworried by the tactics of the defence lawyer. He answered all the questions promptly and in a clear voice. Apparently without much hope, Rogers took him slowly and carefully over the events of those last few minutes. The blood-stained table was in court, so were the three chairs at which they had been sitting, and the gambler's hat with two bullet holes in it. Rogers made Johnson sit in the chair he'd occupied at the time of the murder, to the left of Boyd, and describe again how Boyd had held out his watch towards the Louisville Sport and begged for $100. "And then what happened?" he demanded. Came the answer, "Boyd pulled his gun and shot him, quick as a flash." Rogers pounced. "How could he pull his gun quick as a flash if he'd already held the watch in his right hand? Show me how he did it." Johnson became nervous and unsure. He repeated his story, how the gambler had fallen, dead, how Boyd had tossed the gun under his chair. "But if Boyd tossed the gun under your chair, he must have had to turn towards you with the gun in his right hand. I mean, for a moment, the gun must have been pointing at you. What did you do?"
"Nothing," replied Johnson. "I just sat there."
As he heard this statement, Roger's hand darted to his pocket and came out holding a gun. He pointed the weapon straight at Johnson's stomach. With a yell of fear, Johnson jumped backwards and the chair fell over. The court was in uproar. Several officers tried to grab Rogers under the impression that he really intended to shoot the witness. Rogers looked slightly astonished at the commotion. When it died down, he explained smoothly that he was only trying to show the jury that Johnson's story was unlikely. No man would sit still while another man swung a gun on him, even for a fraction of a second.
The jury took the point, and Johnson was now badly rattled. Rogers continued the cross-examination. "What did you do then? You handed the gun to the bartender? Then what did you do?"
I went to the washroom," said Johnson.
Question: "To wash the powder burns off your hands?" Johnson stammered confusedly. Did I? In effect, he had confessed to the murder. At least that was how the jury saw it. Boyd was found not guilty. Johnson vanished, saving the district attorney the trouble of charging him with murder. This was the first time the gun trick had ever been used in a court of law. Later, Rogers used a number of variations on it. He knew it was a risk, that he might not only lose the case but face a citation for contempt of court, but such trivialities never bothered him. He had the instinct of a gambler, and he enjoyed taking risks. Rogers possessed another quality in common with the professional crook, what George 1984 Orwell called the art of doublethink. It can be seen in the case of his defence of a clumsy murderer called Moutry, who had killed a man in a drunken brawl. In a moving speech, Rogers told the jury, "You cannot convict a man like Moutry on the word of a pimp, a prostitute and a policeman." Moutry was acquitted. As he came up to Rogers, his hand extended, Rogers snapped, "Get away from me, you slimy pimp, you're as guilty as hell." Rogers argued that it was his job to get his client acquitted, whether he believed in his innocence or not. This ability to live by two contrasting kinds of morality can also be found in most professional crooks. The need to convince himself that, although he may be breaking the laws of society, he's not breaking his own moral code. Under the circumstances, it's not surprising that most lawyers who've committed a crime usually manage to persuade themselves of their innocence. This is illustrated by the case of John Barbeau, whose trial in the year 1753 is described in a rare pamphlet printed shortly after his execution. John Barbeau was a young lawyer, the son of a wealthy father who sowed his wild oats soon after qualifying for the bar and left his father to clear up an enormous pile of debts. In 1749, his father packed off the crestfallen young man to the island of St. Christopher, now St. Kitts, in the West Indies. Barbeau was a likeable, if impetuous, type. He soon made friends with a man of his own age, Dr. James Webb, who helped him to find contacts in the town of Basseterre. It was a slow, difficult business, but Barbeau enjoyed life in the islands, the warm climate, the negro slaves, the cheap rum. After 3 years there, he was established as a professional man with a good practice and a small fortune of about £800. In the autumn of 1752, some of Dr. Webb's creditors distrained for debt. Webb owned an estate called Bridgewaters on the island of Nevis. This was seized and offered for sale. Webb was frantic. He was afraid the estate would be sold for a mere fraction of its value by his creditors. With the help of John Barbeau, he tried to get the sale deferred. But it was no good. It came up for sale in November. Webb hoped it would fetch at least £4,500, but not many people had that much money. He and Barbeau agreed gloomily that it might go for as little as £2,000. Then Barbeau had an idea. He could raise £800 in land sales. It was customary to pay a third deposit and the rest within 3 months. His £800 meant that he could bid up to £2,400. Then it would be a question of persuading his father in England to let him have the remainder of the cash. The next morning, he and Webb attended the sale. The creditors were being represented by a solicitor called Matthew Mills, an old inhabitant of the island who was universally liked. Barbeau and his client immediately encountered a setback. The conditions of the sale were read out loud. 1/3 of the money on deposit, and the remainder to be paid within a month. If it wasn't paid, the deposit was to be forfeit. This was bad news. It would take at least a month for a letter to reach England. Barbeau stood up and indignantly objected. The conditions were unreasonable and illegal. There were some angry words, and Matthew Mills accused him of trying to waste time and of boys' play. Barbeau roared indignantly that he expected to be treated like a gentleman, and Mills said that he considered that he had done so. Then the bidding began. The sum went up to just over £2,000. Next, to the general amazement, John Barbeau joined in and offered £2,200. Everyone in the room knew that he didn't possess that kind of money. There were more heated words, but it was finally agreed that Barbeau could have the estate if he paid the deposit and signed the contract.
Barbeau was so upset that his hand shook when he tried to write out an undertaking to pay the remainder within a month. He asked the marshal's attorney, Cottle, to write it out for him. When the attorney handed over the paper, Barbeau could hardly believe his good luck. Either by accident or design, Cottle had made the bill payable within 3 months. However, just as he was about to sign, Matthew Mills looked over his shoulder and indignantly pointed out that he was being given too much time to pay. More heated words followed, and Mills called him an impertinent fellow. Barbeau lost the argument, and the contract was changed again. Outside, in a fury, Barbeau went up to Mills and asked him what he meant by being so rude. Mills, although usually known as a peaceable man, was still angry. He told Barbeau that if he wanted satisfaction, he knew where to find him. Duelling was forbidden, but the law was not strictly observed. If two men intended to fight, they kept the duel a secret, so that if one of them was left dead, the other had a chance of escaping the law. Barbeau brooded on his wrongs. It looked as if he was going to lose all the money he'd managed to save. He decided to take up the offer of satisfaction. He wrote to Mills, asking for an opportunity to rendezvous with Pistols. After some discussion, they agreed to meet on a beach at Frigate's Bay, St. Christopher, early one Sunday morning. By way of providing himself with an alibi, Barbeau stayed with Dr. Webb on the island of Nevis that weekend. This meant that he had to hire a canoe and some Negro rowers to take him across to St. Kitts. He left the doctor's house soon after midnight on November the 26th, 1752. A rainstorm soaked him to the skin, but he found his way to the beach, located the canoe, and was rowed across to Frigate's Bay. Mills rowed up, and they saluted one another. For what happened next, we have to take the word of John Barbeau. He claimed they placed themselves on either side of the road, raised their pistols, and then, at a signal, fired. Or at least, Barbeau fired. Mills groaned, "You've killed me!" and sank down to the ground. He died within a few minutes. By that time, Barbeau was out at sea again, and Mills' Negro boy had run to the nearest house to bring someone to his master. The canoe was seen by a passing boat, the occupants of which recognised Barbeau, and he was also spotted as he stepped ashore on the island of Nevis. Later that same day, he was arrested. It was at this stage that Barbeau, quite incomprehensibly, insisted that he knew nothing of the death of Matthew Mills. He knew that Negroes could not be called on to give evidence in court, therefore all the evidence against him was circumstantial. A week before the duel, he had been heard to say that either he or someone else would soon be dead. The day before the duel, he had been practising shooting pistols at a barrel in Dr. Webb's garden. Various people had seen him, from a distance, after the death of Mills. But all of this did not prove that he was the man who killed him, or so Barbeau decided. It was an utterly gauche defence. Most people present in the court were hard-headed settlers who'd achieved a position in the community through the Puritan ethic of work and common sense. They knew that Barbeau was guilty, and if he had pleaded that Mills was killed in a fair fight, there might have been at least a 50% chance that they would have acquitted him. But they couldn't countenance this legal skullduggery and talk about circumstantial evidence. Barbeau's defence exposed him to another danger. The prosecution called a doctor who alleged that the bullet wound in Mills' right side proved that Mills was not in a posture of defence when he received it. The prosecution also said that Mills' pistols were not ready to fire. In other words, they were suggesting that Barbeau shot him without even waiting for him to prime his pistols. That would be cold-blooded murder. Barbeau should have countered this. He could at least have pointed out that a wound in a man's right side is consistent with a posture of defence, if Mills had his own pistol held out at arm's length with his right side turned towards Barbeau. But instead, Barbeau called various witnesses to try to prove that he was not the man who had been seen leaving Frigate's Bay. The jury would not accept this, found him guilty, and the judge sentenced him to death. Now, when it was too late, the lawyer decided to tell the whole truth. He made a long statement in which he told the story of the quarrel and the duel. But it made no difference. He was executed at Basseterre on January the 20th, 1752, after delivering a moving speech of repentance on the gallows. He confessed that it was his hot temper that had brought him to this sad predicament. But he was wrong. It was his lawyer's capacity for doublethink which had lethally backfired on him. England has had only two notable murder cases involving members of the legal profession. One was of Major Herbert Armstrong. The other, which took place a year earlier, in 1920, was of the lawyer Harold Greenwood, and it ended in his acquittal. Greenwood was a Yorkshireman who came to Kidwelly in Carmarthenshire in Wales in 1898. He was a bluff, cheerful man, but the local Welsh didn't like him very much. There were rumours that, for a married man, he was too interested in the opposite sex. But his wife Mabel was well liked in the area. In her 40s, Mrs. Greenwood began to suffer from fainting attacks. The doctor diagnosed a weak heart, complicated by the usual emotional upheavals of change of life. However, Mabel Greenwood continued to attend various local functions, women's meetings and so on, and during the second week in June 1919, many people thought she looked pale and ill. On the evening of Saturday, June the 14th, a friend thought she looked a beautiful pink, an unusual colour for the usually pale Mrs. Greenwood. After lunch the following day, Mrs. Greenwood began suffering from diarrhoea. The doctor sent her a bismuth medicine for her stomach trouble. However, she became worse as the evening went on. A nurse who had been sent for advised Greenwood to fetch the doctor, but he said he was unwilling to wake him. The nurse finally went herself. Mrs. Greenwood died in the agonies of a bilious attack in the early hours of Monday morning. Dr. Griffiths certified that the death was due to heart disease, and she was buried in the local church. The town was immediately full of rumours. Both the nurse and the vicar were suspicious of the circumstances of Mrs. Greenwood's death. And when, 4 months later, Greenwood married 31-year-old Gladys Jones, daughter of the proprietor of the Llanelli Mercury, the police finally decided to take action. When they informed Greenwood that the body of his wife was to be exhumed, he replied cheerfully, "Just the thing." But when he was told that the inquest proved that Mrs. Greenwood had died of arsenic poisoning, his only comment was, "Oh dear." He was brought to trial in June of 1920, defended by Marshal Hall. The prosecution alleged that he had put arsenic weed killer into the Burgundy, which his wife had drunk with the Sunday lunch. From the beginning, the evidence was contradictory. The housekeeper said that no one else had touched the wine, but Greenwood's daughter, Irene, said that she had drunk it at both lunch and at supper. The parlourmaid stated that Greenwood had spent half an hour before lunch alone in the china pantry. Irene Greenwood testified that her father was outside cleaning the car at the time. The defence suggested that if Mrs. Greenwood had died of arsenic poisoning, it was possible that Dr. Griffiths had put it in the medicine in mistake for bismuth. Another doctor gave evidence that the amount of arsenic found in the body, a quarter of a grain, was not enough to cause death. People can have as much as 2.5 grains in the body without ill effect. He thought that the doctor's tablets had contained too much morphia and that this had killed her. The doctor, who earlier had agreed that the tablets contained morphia, now insisted that they had contained opium. In all the confusion, it was clear that Greenwood could not be found guilty. The jury's verdict was that, while they were satisfied that Mabel Greenwood had absorbed a dose of arsenic just before her death, it was by no means certain that it had been the cause of her death. The day after his acquittal, Greenwood gave a lunch for the reporters who had covered the trial and joked about the absence of Burgundy from the table. But public opinion still accused him of administering small doses of poison to his wife. His practice declined, and he died 8 years later, living in a Herefordshire village under the name of Pilkington, his health completely broken. Whether or not he murdered his wife, there can be no doubt that the gossiping tongues of Kidwelly killed Harold Greenwood.